Hello and welcome to Audio Reader Sports Show. My name is Steve Jack and today we'll read again from the August Sports Illustrated. Welcome to the big time. Under actors Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney, Wrexham became the first team in the history of the English Football League to be promoted in three straight seasons. How have a pair of Hollywood outsiders cracked the code that's flummoxed so many deep-pocketed owners? And there's a picture at the top of the page that accompanies Welcome to the Big Time. It's a picture of the English football team, Wrexham, in red tops, white shorts, all cheering and celebrating with arms in the air in a group photo. And the caption, Imagine Dragons. Few fans would have thought 4 years ago that a tiny team from the fifth tier would now find itself in the championship. Welcome to the Big Time is written by Tor Hogstad. On a September evening in 2020, Rich Fay walked out of a vegan restaurant called Shrub, having had a mushroom kebab with his future wife. He switched his phone back on and saw that he'd missed a text from a friend, then another text, then three more. Ping, 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 ping. The texts were from fellow fans of Wrexham, the club stuck in the fifth tier of English football for the last 12 years. Mate, have you seen this? Ryan Reynolds? What the F is happening? A few days earlier, a club statement had said that unnamed investors were looking to pour $2.5 million into Wrexham, but Ryan Reynolds and fellow actor Rob McElhenney? Fay thought it was a joke. Then he got worried. Fans had wondered why even a local car dealer would buy a club that had just finished in the lower half of the lowest nationwide professional league in England. The Red Dragons didn't have a designated training ground. They played their home games at the crumbling racecourse ground, which they didn't even own at the time. As someone who grew up in this blue-collar city in North Wales, once fueled by coal and steel, Fay says you wouldn't just be made fun of for supporting Wrexham, you'd be made fun of for living in Wrexham. He had a theory. They're both comedians, says Fay, a journalist who co-hosts the Wrexham podcast, Rob Ryan Red. I thought they might be making a mockumentary. Oh, look at this crap little football team. Less than 5 years after that September evening, Wrexham will play in the second tier of the English Football League, which is where Wrexham plays, despite being located in Wales. They've been promoted three seasons in a row, a first for EFL history, which leaves one giant question. In the loss-making, rule-bending shark tank of British club ownership, how did the winners become the guy who plays Van Wilder and Deadpool and the creator of a sitcom about some friends running an Irish bar in Philadelphia? And our second photo shows Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney celebrating as they hold a championship trophy. Reynolds pups his fist in the air at the same time. And the caption, show business. McElhenney and Reynolds have turned their team into a compelling story, one that sponsors are lining up to associate with. In the second episode of Welcome to Wrexham, the FX reality show that debuted in August of 2022, McElhenney sports a handlebar mustache in front of a white wall. Talking to the camera, he says, not sure what to get your special someone this holiday? Over upbeat guitar music, the screen switches to Reynolds. Tired of opening the same old scarf or sweater? Try I-4 Williams Trailers. Much like the ownership of Wrexham, the ad feels like a spoof, but it's not. I-4 Williams was the main sponsor for Reynolds, and McElhenney took over the club from a fan trust in February of 2021, and the clip reveals the secret sauce. Advertising, straight and undistilled, sprinkled throughout the series, Episode 7 starts by listing the main sponsors with logos and endorsing voiceovers from the owners. I-4, TikTok, Expedia, Aviation, Gin, the last of which is co-owned by Reynolds, who is also co-founder of the marketing firm Maximum Effort. You can tell. Wrexham later signed up United Airlines, HP, Gatorade, MetaQuest. You get the idea. There's no subtlety here. Reynolds and McElhaney are telling us they're trying to grow brand exposure. So here's another ad. We're doing this. It's working, and we don't mind that you know. The deals are a catch for a club playing in front of about 12,000 fans every other week. But this was never about the locals. More than half of Wrexham's income was generated outside of Europe during the 23-24 season, the latest for which financial results are public. The stadium name has been sold off to Stoke Cold Brew Coffee, a U.S.-based company that doesn't even sell its product in Wales. Global brands such as TikTok, United Airlines, and Aviation Gin realize they can leverage off the appeal of Wrexham, says Kieran McGuire, a finance academic and the author of The Price of Football. And they want to be associated with the success of the club and also, of course, the success of the show. Reynolds and McElhaney also advertise tens of millions of people on social media. They do interviews and podcasts and talk shows. It's crazy, says Faye, and now the revenues are insane. In 2021, the season in which Ryan and Rob took over the team, Wrexham generated a total of about $1.5 million in revenue. When playing in the fourth tier, League Two, in 2023-24, they earned nearly $33.7 million. That was more than 11 of the clubs in the second tier, the Championship, according to The Athletic, which estimated that the commercial income, like ad deals, ticked in at $24.9 million, more than five clubs in the Premier League. Even after three promotions, the brand has grown faster than the team. The revenue has given the club an enormous advantage. When in the fifth tier, the National League, the owners simply paid really good players lots of money to play for them, they lured Paul Mullen, the top goal scorer in the fourth tier, away from Cambridge United in 2021. They signed Ollie Palmer, a striker from third-tier Wimbledon, for a then-club-record transfer fee of just over $400,000. They were probably League One quality even when they were in the National League, says Omar Shadori, chief intelligence officer at 21st Club, which bills models, then estimates team strength. There's no deeper secret for how Wrexham got a good team, they bought one. Even better, most of their rival owners haven't been able to spend this much on players, even if they've had the cash. In the fourth tier, clubs must keep spending on players below 50% of annual revenue, and in the third tier, the cap rises to 60%. The exception has been cash from equity investment, though that loophole closes this coming season. In the second tier, it's not a percentage but a cap on how much clubs can lose over a rolling three-year cycle. These rules are meant to help clubs stay sustainable and to make sure that a guy like Jeff Bezos can't simply buy Grimsby Town and hoover up players with Amazon money. So for a club to spend a lot, it has to earn a lot. While Reynolds and McElhaney finance much of this initial outlay, Wrexham has been powered by sponsor revenue, one of the few things worth more to modern football than actual money. To their credit, Reynolds and McElhaney know what they don't know. One of their first and best moves was to hire Sean Harvey, an executive who had worked for Leeds and Bradford City in the top tier. It had been the CEO of the English Football League. Signings? Stadium expansion? Harvey knows. He advised the owners to get manager Phil Parkinson. The owners basically said, okay, let's do that. And then Parkinson said no, so McElhaney went after him, in the words of Reynolds, like a dog with a bone. McElhaney called Parkinson from a parking lot where he spent the next 90 minutes selling the coach on the club. This self-awareness alone elevates Reynolds and McElhaney above the far too many owners who seem physically unable to spend money on their club. their business without meddling in the football stuff. Enough investors and entrepreneurs believe they are best suited to handpick coaches and players worth tens of millions of dollars, based merely on the same I know best hunches as the fan in the pub. It says something about English football ownership when two Hollywood actors are among the people most grounded in reality. Instead, Reynolds and McElhinney have done what they do best, which is to give their audience a moving story. Welcome to Wrexham tears down the fourth wall to give viewers memes, reels, outtakes, and self-deprecation, making it far funnier than the slew of unbearably polished club documentaries that flood streaming platforms. It's also honest about the risk involved. As McElhinney tells Reynolds in the first episode, there is a version of this story where we are the villains. The story was always at the center of the investment. Even the recommendation to buy Wrexham came from Humphrey Kerr, a British screenwriter and actor who was working with McElhinney on the series Mythic Quest back in 2020. Kerr told McElhinney to check out Sutherland Till I Die, the gritty Netflix documentary series about the giant club from northeast England that got stuck in League One for what would ultimately be four seasons. When McElhinney realized that clubs in English football can travel up and down the divisions, he told Kerr, "We should do this," which meant buying an actual club. He dispatched Kerr to draw up a list of targets. Kerr later told British GQ that his research amounted to scrolling Wikipedia and checking out the stats section of the video game Football Manager, where others saw Wrexham as a backwater. Kerr and McElhinney saw a wounded underdog. Wrexham is the third oldest professional club in the world, and over the last 25 years, the fans have been torched by threats of bankruptcy, a 10-point deduction for going into administration, and an owner who tried to kick the club out of the stadium so he could sell it, all of which affected the mood among the 60,000 people in the city. The football club's success is interlinked with the confidence of the town itself, says Faye. If the club is doing well, the town is doing well. The owners understood that by lifting the club, they could change lives. Once Reynolds and McElhinney set foot in Wrexham in October 2021, having only watched the team on internet streams, they greeted fans, kids, pensioners, shop owners, and even an exorcist tasked by the church with investigating paranormal activity. They posed for selfies, signed shirts, watched a power chair game, and downed shots with fans in the turf pub next to the racehorse. They hugged it out with the players, saying they could come to them with anything. According to Reynolds, one player called him and asked if he could book him a rental car. When Wrexham didn't get promoted in the first full season after losing in heartbreaking fashion in the promotion playoffs, the series showed us the despair in the people, the tears, the agony, the what's going to give us joy now. When Wrexham did go up a year later, thousands of people lined the streets for an open-top bus parade as the fans sang Elvis Presley's Can't Help Falling in Love. Kerr, now a director at the club, cried for the first time in 10 years. When Wrexham reached the championship with a 3-0 win over Charlton in April, it was Reynolds who broke down in tears. "These fans effing deserve it," said Mullen. Now, though, Wrexham is in a place where the air is significantly thinner. And there's a photograph that shows hundreds of people, many wearing red, gathering in the racecourse grounds, and the caption, "Bigger and Better." Fans routinely pack matches as the soon-to-be-expanded racecourse ground, including April's promotion, clinching win. The championship is the football version of a casino. One promotion away from the hyper-lucrative Premier League, club owners gamble cash that can only be recouped by either finishing in the top two or winning the third promotion spot through a four-team playoff. "We refer to the championship as the clown car of European football," says Maguire. "It makes no sense whatsoever." McGuire said that in 10 of the last 12 years, the total wage bill of the 24 clubs has exceeded their revenue. Before you've turned on the floodlights, before you've cut the grass, before you've even signed any players, clubs are losing money, he says. The clubs that have dropped down from the Premier League come armed with parachute payments, a stack of cash paid out for having hit the big time, even for just a year. Some will have revenue of $130 million, likely more than three times that of Wrexham. As Chiduri points out, the financial gap between top and bottom is far greater than in League One. The slope gets steeper as you go up the pyramid, he says. Parkinson knows this all too well, having reached the championship twice. I remember when I took Bolton up in 2017. It was, phew, this is huge in terms of the physicality and the power in the division, he said right after Wrexham's promotion, and added that the jump in salaries is incredible, mind-blowing. According to 21st Group, Wrexham was about 20th best team in the league at the start of the summer. I'd be very surprised if they're promoted straight away, says Chiduri. I think a mid-table finish would be a fantastic result for them. More challenges await. With 12,600 seats, the racecourse is among the smallest stadiums in the league, and the construction of a new stand will temporarily reduce capacity. Tickets are already hard to find, and Faye says there could be a tipping point where Wrexham becomes unaffordable to locals, a trend that is spread across the top clubs in the Premier League. Fortunately for the locals, fan opinion matters. Since Rob and Ryan have so much to lose, their credibility is on the line, says Faye. They don't want to make any unpopular decisions. Damage trust among the community, and you rip out the heart of the show. What makes it even better is that this isn't a state, says Faye, referring to ownership groups such as the Saudi government's Public Investment Fund, which owns Premier League club Newcastle United. This isn't some dirty businessman who's got blood money. This is just two celebrities, and what's on the line for them is not money, it's reputation, because if Wrexham fails, Ryan Reynolds fails. There aren't many football teams or businesses where you genuinely like the guys in charge. A bigger question, given that the success has been driven by brand exposure, is what happens when the documentary stops? No series can run forever, even if it's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, now airing in its 17th season. The fans might worry about the day the club owners turn off the cameras, sell, and leave. They are a bigger brand than the football club itself, says McGuire. So, how are you going to persuade global sponsors to continue to have that level of engagement with Wrexham if the owners are no longer attached to it? The exception, McGuire says, is if Wrexham gets to the Premier Club, a global drama series in its own right. Then, to a certain extent, the club should be able to become slightly more self-sufficient, he says. Faye thinks Wrexham needs the show less now than before. The documentary gave us validity and a platform, he says, and now we're on that stage. You can watch every Wrexham game in the U.S., so the fans who follow us will continue to do so. And if you get the Premier League, you don't need a documentary. Could other clubs copy Wrexham? McGuire thinks it would be difficult. You'll end up with football documentary fatigue, he says. What they do have is first mover advantage. They've built up a cult following. They're also using the right people in front of the camera. We know Ryan Reynolds. It's impossible to dislike him. So I think the chances of being able to repeat that are relatively remote. At least their rivals can jot down some lessons from Wrexham about what sport can be in 2025, when every player and team can be sold as content. To win in football, you don't have to know everything about it. You don't even have to know the rules, as long as you tell the best story. And as Reynolds and McElhaney know, the best stories are about people. The underdog was never the team, but the town. And related to that, Wrexham on the rise under their new owners, the Red Dragons, have moved up 3 divisions and nearly 70 rungs on the English football ladder. And there's a picture of a Wrexham player in action. He's in the air by the corner flag with fans cheering behind him. And this caption, "Wise investment, acquired for a club record fee of $3 million in the middle of last season, Sam Smith scored 7 times in 18 games." And below the photo is this chart of their march from the National League to the, which is the fifth and the lowest of the tiers, to the EFL League 2, and that's the fourth division, and the EFL League 1 at 3, and EFL Championship at 2, and they have yet to reach the Premier League. In that season before Ryan and Rob bought the team, they were 110th overall, 19th out of 24 in that lowest division, and their record was 11, 10, and 16. And the next year, they moved to 100th best in all the tiers. They were 8th out of 24 in that lowest division, and their record was 19, 11, and 12. They moved up the next year to 94th best, and they were 2nd out of 24 in that bottom division, and their record was 26, 10, and 8. Then they moved to 93rd, just a little bit better. They were 1st in that lowest league of 24, and their record was 34, 9, and 3. Then they moved up to League 2. They were overall 70th best out of all the leagues. They were 2nd in the league with 24, and their record was 26, 10, and 10. And this last year, overall, they were 46th best team. Again, they started before Ryan and Rob bought the team at 110th. Now they're the 46th best team in all the league, or on all the tiers, and 2nd in the league of 24 teams, and their record was 27, 11, and 8. Our next article comes from the scorecard section of SI. It's an essay, "Pad Habits Die Hard." Like so many parents, MLB managers are dealing with the issue of their charges' excessive screen time. The article is written by Stephanie Epstein, and the photographs taken by Eric W. Rasko. And the first one shows a baseball player seated in the dugout, sunglasses on, as he studies his iPad, the one that he is holding. "Pad Habits Die Hard" by Stephanie Epstein. In late April, Rangers manager Bruce Bochy saw something he didn't like. It wasn't just the lackluster at-bats that had his team 26th in the majors in OPS, 29th in walks per strikeout, and 30th in runs scored. It was what was happening during those at-bats in the dugout. "There's times when guys do something good, come in, and their teammates' heads are down," Bochy says. "Those heads are looking at the 20 iPads Major League Baseball supplies for use during games. A few go to the bullpen and the day's starting pitcher, but they are mostly claimed by the hitters, who pore over their swing mechanics, review the pitcher's offerings, or fact-check an umpire's call. They're helpful," Bochy admits, "but I think we get a little caught up in the process instead of watching the game and competing out there." So the Rangers made what has become an increasingly common decision among MLB teams as they grapple with the proliferation of technology. The team took the iPads away, echoing parents everywhere. Baseball coaches are beginning to complain that the problem with Gen Z is too much screen time. The Rangers scored 15 runs their first night as Luddites, and Bochy allowed himself a smile or two. "I loved it," he says. "I really did." But 2 days later, after the team scored 1 run, then none, they gave them back. Team officials had made their point. "You don't want to take away any resource that might make them better," Bochy says. "But it's also just a reminder, hey, it's okay to watch the game." And there's a photograph of 2 Texas Rangers players walking out to the field, gloves on, both wearing big, big smiles. And the caption, "Lone Star Low Tech, the Rangers had plenty to smile about after temporarily giving up their iPads on April 29th when they hung a 15 spot on the A's." For much of baseball history, the most players could hope for was grainy broadcast film or some Zapruder footage from the stands. About a decade ago, teams opened video rooms within the ballparks, and almost immediately, coaches began to lament, so many hitters fled there to review their swings, that dugouts were empty during games. MLB cut off in-game access in 2020 as part of COVID-19 protocols. The restriction, of course, came in the context of an MLB investigation that found the Astros had used the replay room to steal signs illegally. The players had already had access to dugout iPads for scouting information and historical video. In 21, the league gave them video during games on a slight delay, cut so they could not see the catcher's signs. Even the oldest school coaches acknowledge some jealousy in the amount of visual feedback hitters have these days. I wish I had them, says Rangers hitting coach Brett Boone. The former all-star second baseman, who was brought on board in May in part because he's the sort of guy who sometimes reminds players jovially, get the F off your iPads. But he joins the growing old guard that sees loss as well as gain, starting with the image TV viewers see at least once per game of a dugout full of players staring at iPads. You start to get dependent on it, and you're starting to miss what's most important, says Dodgers manager Dave Roberts, whose team also cut down on iPads for a stretch in 2022 at the suggestion of first baseman Freddie Freeman. They kept one so players who had an important concern could glance at it between innings, but otherwise they required eyes on the field. We just need to have guys focused on the game, recalls third baseman Max Muncy. So what are the important factors the iPad obscures? Pitch tipping, for one. The videos are cut starting at the moment the pitcher begins his motion, meaning you can't watch him come set and perhaps take a big breath before he throws a fastball. Some veteran bench players do see this change as offering job security. They can use their eyes to pick up a minuscule motion that no one else, especially someone looking at a screen, caught. They can also take a matchup out of context. The scouting report may say that a pitcher throws a curveball 20% of the time in a certain count. But, says veteran outfielder Kevin Pillar, if I'm the seventh hitter, I can see he hasn't thrown a curveball for a strike to the first six hitters. He might be able to eliminate that pitch. And there's a picture of a half a dozen players coaches in the dugout, and they're all leaning against the railing in the dugout looking at the field, looking at the action. And the iPads can distort the rhythm of the game entirely. You miss how quick the game really is, says Nationals manager Davey Martinez, who took the devices away for the last month of last season. On the iPad, you can make it slow, slow, slow. Game speed can actually be helpful when a player might be prone to overanalyzing, which watching video encourages. You're unlikely to be able to make a mechanical change during a game. If you're having swing thoughts in the box, you're probably not succeeding, says Guardians catcher Austin Hedges. If you want to look at the iPad, put 50 line drives at 98 miles an hour on there, says Martinez. But those guys will go back and look, and they swing at a ball that went 55 feet. You don't need the iPad, I can tell you. Stop chasing. Several managers and coaches have also expressed concern that the instant video breeds an obsession with reviewing balls and strikes. Where a hitter might once have had to wait for the final out of the inning, go play defense, and only then head to the video room if a call was still eating at them, he can now have someone hand him an iPad before he even puts his bat down. You had a two-strike count on you, says Angels manager Ron Washington. You can't take a pitch that breaks that close. But because the iPad agrees it was a ball, the player feels self-righteous instead of learning a two-strike approach. And regardless, the at-bat is over. But most of all, coaches worry that players are so focused on the details that they lose sight of the whole enterprise. We're a team trying to beat another team, in the present moment, not on an iPad, says Dodgers first base coach Chris Woodward. And there's another photo. This is Steve Kwan holding up an iPad to show what he's watching on the screen. And the caption, point of viewing, using a tablet hasn't hurt. All-star Steve Kwan of the Guardians, while the Dodgers try to keep their focus on the field in that previous photo. The tools are helpful, and they definitely aren't going away. Most minor league teams have at least a few iPads, so players arrive in the majors fully fluent in the technology and often reliant on it. So there is an advantage to be found in teaching players to use it well. Instead of talking about what you shouldn't be doing, coaches have the opportunity to explain what to look for, says Guardians field coordinator Kai Correa. Overuse of iPads is not about the iPads, he says. It's an indication that a player does not understand the value of watching the game on the field. So he tries to point out what he sees and why that is relevant. And hitters see an opportunity to reclaim some of the ground they have lost to pitchers in the development wars over the past few years. A pitcher can use data to optimize a pitch. At least the hitters can use data to get a good sense of what it's doing. This game that we play now is so much more information-based than that we need the metrics, says Mets left fielder Brandon Nimmo. He likes to track a pitcher's vertical break and horizontal movement in real time so he can adjust where he expects the ball to end up. This, like, we'll just go up there and kind of see what they have deal is kind of a thing of the past, he says. This is a classic baseball conundrum. The only constant of the sport is that it's changing and its participants must adapt. Why not have the old thing and the new thing, says Correa. Why not have quality conversations, experiences, watching in real time, iterating, reacting, and also planning and reviewing and measuring? I will never, ever be comfortable with the argument that they're mutually exclusive. And as for that TV image of a dugout full of players with their heads down, Correa sees it differently. The irony of that is that if they're showing that in-game, he says, that means nothing's happening on the field. Our next article from the scorecard section of this month's SI, History, Overdue Return. Alongside Pete Rose and Shoeless Joe, a long-forgotten ace is reinstated. Overdue Return is written by Mark McCarter and is accompanied by our first photo, which is black and white, of pitcher Phil Douglas in his gray pinstriped uniform. Overdue Return. Phil Douglas was, in the harsh, unforgiving judgment of his day, a drunk. Offered a sports writer of the 1920s, his great shortcoming was endeavoring to lap up all the firewater in every village he visited. Douglas was a footnote then and continues to be now, despite his World Series heroics in 1921 when he won two games for the New York Giants and struck out Babe Ruth three times. Shufflin' Phil Douglas, the Shufflin' because of his slow, slouching gait, was one of the lesser-known baseball players banished for life by the imperious commissioner, Kenesaw Mountain Landis. When current MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred decreed in May that a person no longer with us cannot represent a threat to the integrity of the game and that permanent ineligibility ends upon the passing of the disciplined individual, Douglas became one of the 17 to receive a reprieve, but his was lost in the sports talk debate over the guilt, Hall of Fame potential, and legacies of Pete Rose and Shoeless Joe Jackson. On a partly cloudy spring day, not long after Manfred's decree, Douglas lies at rest near the flagpole at the hub of Tracy City Cemetery in the peaceful afternoon disturbed by dueling weed eaters tending to the grounds. His gravesite is in the shade of a flowering dogwood tree and marked by a 2-foot granite baseball headstone with a comb-over of moss and lichen. Douglas was buried in 1952 in this tiny Tennessee town atop the Cumberland Plateau 50 miles northwest of Chattanooga, 30 years after a distraught, distorted letter led to his lifetime suspension from baseball. Just down the road a piece at the Grundy County Historical Society Museum, the Douglas reinstatement is greeted with a raise-the-roof gesture, punctuated by whoopee and it's about time. A picture of Douglas hangs on the library wall. A short bio of Douglas in a thick tome of county history describes him as a bear of a right-handed pitcher with a wicked spitball and erratic behavior. From the Historical Society, you are directed catty-corner to Henry Flurry and Sons, a red-roofed old-style general store and grocery in its 120th year. P.C. Flurry sits at the cashier's cubicle. His father, Henry, was among those who raised money for Douglas's headstone and legal expenses by selling free fill campaign buttons. He drank a little, a lot, Flurry says of Douglas. After he was kicked out, he worked around here at a sawmill, and he was a ringer they hired to pitch in some of these amateur leagues. I never heard anything negative about him. I always heard he got shanghaied. And there is a photograph of that headstone. It's in a graveyard. It's shaped like a baseball with the stitching that reads, Phil Douglas, 1890 to 1952, with roses laid in front of it. And the caption, shuffling home after a career in which he won 94 games, cut short, Douglas returned to Tennessee. Aptly nicknamed Little Napoleon, the 5'7" John McGraw was the archetype of the flinty manager of the day, unwilling to walk away from a brawl or controversy and often inviting them. He won 2,763 games over 33 seasons with the Orioles and Giants with a 58.6% winning percentage, 10 pennants, and 3 World Series titles. McGraw's 1922 Giants were the defending world champions, and Douglas suffered only 2 losses in his first 14 starts. But in a July slump, McGraw grew impatient with his team and with the lack of reliability from the 32-year-old Douglas at his penchant for climbing inside a whiskey bottle. The sacrifice of his fishing and drinking days between starts was a big one for Phil Douglas, and one which, for all his love of baseball, he was not always willing to make, wrote the late Tom Clark, a former Grundy County High agriculture teacher and author of One Last Round for the Shuffler. Little Napoleon took some drastic measures. Having already suspended Douglas in the past, McGraw temporarily assigned a keeper to monitor the pitcher off the field and steer him away from liquor. On July 30th, with the pennant race growing tighter, the Pirates bombarded Douglas. McGraw snarled, "Where's your bottle hid?" Douglas pleaded innocence and demanded a trade, which McGraw refused. Douglas left the park for a friend's apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where he got drunk and passed out. McGraw enlisted 2 detectives who hauled him to jail under false circumstances. Kidnapping is not too strong a word for the scenario, and a Giants coach delivered Douglas to the West End Sanitarium. There he was subject to a process called Keeley Cure, which included stomach pumping, treatments with hot soaks, and injections of sedatives. Douglas was released after 5 days, then reported to the Polo Grounds on Monday, August 7th. There he learned that the Giants had billed him for the taxi ride to the sanitarium and his 5-day stay. Plus, he was fined $100 and docked his pay. A disheveled Douglas was still under the influence of the sanitarium's depressants and a 2-day post-treatment whiskey binge, so McGraw scolded him viciously in front of his teammates. In an empty clubhouse after the game, Douglas snatched a piece of Giant stationery and wrote to a former Cubs teammate, Les Mann, then with the Cardinals, "I want to leave here, but I want some inducement," Douglas wrote. "I don't want this guy to win the pennant, and if I stay here, I will win it for him. You know how I can pitch and win? So you see the fellows, and if you want to, send a man over here with the goods, and I will leave for home on the next train." And there's next a photo of that button with Douglas's face on it and the words, "Free Phil." The Cardinals' straight arrow outfielder shared the letter with equally pious St. Louis manager Branch Rickey, who suggested Mann send it to the commissioner. Douglas wasn't making an offer to throw games. He was, in his addled state, looking for an exit from McGraw's abuse. The letter wasn't Pete Rose arrogantly scribbling, "I'm sorry, I bet on baseball," while signing an autograph, or the courtroom confessions of some of the Black Sox. But Landis, installed in the wake of the 1919 scandal, was charged with restoring the sport's integrity, and even the faintest whiff of impropriety would be met with the death penalty of a life sentence. Now he is a disgraced ball player, just as crooked as the players who threw the 1919 World Series, Landis said at a press conference. He will never play another game in organized baseball, and not a league will knowingly admit him to its parks. It seemed like an overreaction from the commissioner, says Douglas's great-grandson, Joshua Frizzell. He made a silly mistake in writing that letter. I don't know what his mindset was, but it seemed he felt instant regret after doing it. From what I've heard, he just made a stupid, drunk decision. McGraw threw in some parting shots that his value to the club has been little or nothing. However, Douglas was 11-4 at the time with a league-low 2.63 ERA and the best hits-to-innings ratio in the National League. He would finish with a 94-93 career record with 2.80 ERA and a 1.192 whip, now good for 146th all-time in the latter category, sandwiched between Mike Mussina, Sonny Gray, and just above Warren Spahn. "I may never get back into organized baseball," Douglas responded, "but before long I'll force them to admit that I was not guilty of any crookedness. I never threw a game in my life, and my record during my years in baseball speaks for itself. McGraw gave me a dirty deal, and the public will soon find out that I am innocent. I haven't always kept in the best condition, but I've always done my best. The letter put me in an awful fix and makes everything look bad for me, but I'm not concealing anything. I want the public to know that I am not guilty of any crooked baseball." And there is another picture. This is a stern-looking gentleman, white hair, dressed in a dark suit. "Long arm of the law," says the caption. Appointed in 1920, in the wake of the Black Sox scandal, Landis, then a federal judge, was the game's first commissioner. The Georgia-born Douglas returned that fall from New York to Birmingham, where he and his first wife, Louise, lived a rather tenuous existence. One particular drunken evening, he beat Louise, leaving her with two black eyes, and Phil with a visit from the police. He found employment as a ringer with myriad semi-pro teams, but eventually the Birmingham house was repossessed. Louise died of cancer in 1927, and Phil settled in Tennessee with his daughters. He continued to pitch and to drink. He was dirt poor, scrambling for various odd jobs from road work to a coal mine to a sawmill. "He was a perfect grandpa. He was precious to us," says granddaughter Mary Boston. "And he seldom missed a Wednesday night church service, dazzling the congregation with his singing voice. Ill health, including three strokes, led to his death in 1952 at age 62. I know the lifetime suspension ruined our lives, his and ours. It cost us our education, everything," says Douglas's daughter, Eunice Douglas Shoemate, in a 1990 interview with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Her quotation was part of a series of stories by writer Jay Searcy, who had launched his career in nearby Chattanooga. He wrote that Douglas was a lovable, caring, but saddened figure who was too embarrassed, so he died concealing his grief, his guilt, and his anger. Searcy's initial story was headlined "Punishment That Didn't Fit the Crime." As Douglas told a former teammate, Hillis Lane, "I drank, but I didn't do anything wrong." Searcy's story caught the attention of New Jersey attorney Joseph McCullough, Jr., who connected the Tracy City attorney, Stephen Greer, the eventual chair of the committee to reinstate Phil Douglas, which included Searcy, McCullough, Henry Fleury, and a brace of family members whose life struggles left them with little hope and even less ammunition to clear Douglas's name. They composed a letter to Commissioner Faye Vincent pleading for a hearing to discuss reinstatement, but Vincent refused. Vincent was following the precedent set a year earlier when his predecessor, Bart Diamante, turned down pleas on behalf of shoeless Joe Jackson. It would be another 35 years before Manfred's reprieve. When I was reading about the Pete Rose, I was, well, Phil Douglas, they better include him too, says Frizzell. It was shocking. It was unexpected, but I was really, really happy about it. And there's a final photo of Douglas roaring back to throw the ball. Says Boston, it gave me a chill, but there is a tinge of melancholy. The saddest thing is that people remember him that were closest to him. A lot of them have passed away. There's just a few of us in the family now, but it's still a thing to us, Boston adds. In retrospect, it's easy enough to understand Landis's decision, as he was still dealing with the stench from the Black Sox scandal. The priority of integrity of the game, understandably, took precedent over the impact of an individual whose alcoholism had more than a little culpability in the situation. Less understandable was the reluctance of ensuing commissioners to review or reverse the decision, even as the court of public sentiment seemed to agree that, well, the punishment didn't fit the crime. As Rich Levin, a spokesman for Vincent, told UPI in 1990, "We have received some written material, and we have lawyers who are looking into it. But to be honest with you, it's unlikely that we will attempt to rewrite history." Yet Manfred, perhaps under pressure from the White House, chose to do just that. It'll be interesting to see how history regards Shufflin' Phil Douglas, a player barely a footnote after Pete Rose and shoeless Joe Jackson, but a man folks atop the Cumberland Plateau believed to be even more deserving of vindication. Our next article from Scorecard section of SI, Game Plan, Shooting Star. Happy Gilmore 2 showcases the golf world's favorite fictional villain. And there is a photograph of two actors, Christopher McDonald and Adam Sandler. They're facing each other in what appears to be a graveyard. McDonald wearing a navy shirt, Sandler with a blue plaid shirt. And the caption, Happy Place, McDonald got back together with Sandler after encouraging him to take a shot at a sequel. Shooting Star is written by Mark Bechtel. I am a nice guy, insists Christopher McDonald, and after talking to him for a few minutes, it becomes clear that he is, very much so, in fact. But when a role calls for a little smarm, or a lot of it, the 70-year-old admits, I've got it in me. That bad guy energy was most famously on display in 1996 Happy Gilmore, in which he played obnoxious pro golfer Shooter McGavin. I do like being the villain because you get carte blanche, says McDonald. It's like, hey, bring it, whatever you got. I just think it's a blast because it's like total opposite of me. I love doing that kind of stuff because without a really good bad guy, it doesn't help out the hero. The actor's career has been filled with a wide range of roles. He was in Darren Aronofsky's wonderful but oh-so-bleak Requiem for a Dream and was nominated for an Emmy in 2022 for his work in the comedy Hacks. Buddy Friedley admits that when he's recognized 99% of the time, it's for playing Shooter. So when the opportunity came up to reprise the role in Happy Gilmore 2, McDonald jumped at it. In fact, he had been pestering star Adam Sandler to make a sequel, which premiered on Netflix on July 25th, for years, partly because it's virtually guaranteed to be a success, and partly because he had so much fun filming the first one. It's often been said that every hockey player's favorite movie is Slapshot. Judging by the cast of Happy Gilmore 2, the original made a lasting impression on more people than McDonald. Cameos from players abound, including Scottie Scheffler, Rory McIlroy, and Bryson DeChambeau. In one scene, the pros are all assembled in one room. Says McDonald, I walked in right between their setups, and every one of them, the younger guys and the older guys, they were pulling the guns out and going, Shooter! The hair on the back of my neck was tingly. I talked to Jack Nicklaus for 2 hours. McDonald plays in a dozen or so charity events a year, which suits his skills. I got a game and a scramble, he says. That's my forte. The sequel finds Shooter and Happy both down on their luck, which leads to a movie that's not nearly as silly as the original. Sandler isn't in full Uncut Gems mode, but he does bring a little more dramatic heft to the role now than he did 29 years ago. Adam has depth, says McDonald, and this movie is really about family. These are big, big themes. Which is not to say the movie isn't funny. It is. And that it distances itself from the first film. References to the original are everywhere. But not in the annoying, let's just do the same thing we did then way that bogs down so many sequels. Familiar faces are back, but not all of them. Carl Weathers, the actor who played Chubbs, died earlier this year, but his spirit lives on in a training montage that seems inspired by a similar scene in Rocky II, in which Weathers played Apollo Creed. Says McDonald, the people that we play homage to in the sequel are a big part of the film. The result is a movie that's lighter on broad humor, but deeper on heart. So would McDonald be up for another go-round? I would love to do a third, but who knows? I mean, it took this long to get this one done, he says. Even if it doesn't happen, being back in character and on set with Sandler and the gang is enough. He's not Mr. Gilmore, but he adds, I'm over the moon happy. Next, scorecard, full frame, light show, photographed by Heinz Klutmeier. And the photograph is a picture of a pitcher rearing back for a throw to home plate, but the photo is dominated by the grandstand behind him and the bright lights atop the grandstand illuminating the action. The photographers on hand for the seemingly meaningless NL East matchup between the fourth-place Cubs and fifth-place Phillies faced a new challenge, shooting under the lights at Wrigley Field. And there were plenty on hand. Credentials were issued to 522 media members, including SI photographer Heinz Klutmeier and writer Ron Firmwright. After nearly 74 years of exclusively day baseball, Wrigley hosted his first night game on August 8, 1988. It was the culmination of years of legal wrangling between the team and traditionalists. A 91-year-old fan declared, "Let there be light," before flipping the switch to illuminate the field. The temperature during the day had been nearly 100 degrees, bolstering the argument of the pro-night crowd. 3 innings after Rick Sutcliffe's first pitch, the purists got their revenge in the form of an act of baseball gods. The skies opened, and the game was rained out. Our next article is from SI.com. Second person arrested for throwing object at WNBA game. Caden Lopez, 18, faces 3 charges, and this is written by Patrick Andres. An epidemic of fans throwing adult objects onto the court rocks the WNBA. A second alleged prankster has been arrested. Caden Lopez, 18, is facing charges after allegedly chucking an object during the Phoenix Mercury's 82-66 home win over the Connecticut Sun Tuesday. The object is said to have struck a man watching the game with his 9-year-old niece. Police charged Lopez with assault, disorderly conduct, and public display of explicit sexual material, according to court documents obtained by Jessica Johnson of KSAZ-TV in Phoenix. Lopez's alleged prank is thought to be the 5th instance in the last 10 days of an individual throwing an adult object at a WNBA game. The first arrest of 23-year-old Delbert Carver was made Saturday after he allegedly threw an adult object on July 29th during the Atlanta Dreams game against the Golden State Valkyries. Per Johnson, Lopez apologized and called the alleged incident a stupid prank that was trending on social media. Next, NFLPA issues clarifying statement on smelling salts ban. Teams are no longer permitted to provide the salts, but there's no rule about players using them. Liam McKeon wrote this article. Amid all the drama littering the NFL landscape during training camp, the most unexpected was easily the smelling salts controversy. Earlier this week, San Francisco 49ers star George Kittle stormed the set of NFL Network to announce the league had banned smelling salts, joking that he considered retirement due to the change. The news sent ripples throughout the rest of the NFL's player base, and few were pleased about the development. On Wednesday, though, the NFLPA issued a clarifying statement to players that should make Kittle and others of his ilk quite happy. The NFL has banned teams from providing the salts, but players are still permitted to use them. The NFL Players Association is aware of the memo issued by the league Tuesday regarding the use of smelling salts in ammonia capsules, read the statement per ESPN's Kalen Kaler. We were not notified of this club policy change before the memo was set out. To clarify, this policy does not prohibit player use of these substances, but rather it restricts clubs from providing or supplying them in any form. The NFL has confirmed this to us. So, it turns out there won't be too big a change after all. And finally, Naomi Osaka announces triumphant return with run to Canadian Open Final. Osaka is back in a big way, written by Blake Silverman. Naomi Osaka is off to the final at the National Bank Open in Montreal, marking her first appearance in a WTA 1000 final since 2022. She took down world number 19 Clara Tauson in straight sets, 6-2, 7-6 in her semifinal match, setting up a highly anticipated final with 18-year-old Canadian sensation Victoria Momko Thursday evening. Osaka ousted Tauson in a second set tiebreak after she trailed 3-0 to officially announce her triumphant return. Osaka's last WTA 1000 win came at the China Open in 2019. However, she did win the U.S. Open in 2020 and the Australian Open in 2021. She's won both those major events twice for a total of 4 career major wins. She took a hiatus in 2023 as she was expecting her first child before making her return to the courts the next year. She's currently the WTA world number 49, but we'll see that ranking rise through the roof after her run in Montreal, right in time for the U.S. Open, which begins at the end of August. She was ranked number 1 in the world for 25 weeks total, all in 2019. And that's all the time we have for this edition of The Sports Show. My name is Steve Jack. Thanks for joining me.